we now tend to think, I think, that the idea that there's a relationship between our health and the environment, we tend to think that that is a pretty modern idea. Now we have an understanding of things like germs and pollution. But the fact of the matter is that this is not necessarily a new idea, that, for example, people in the 19th century, although they didn't know about germs and they might not have had the kind of understanding we have of why people get sick, they did indeed think a lot about the relationship between their health and the place they lived. And that is what we'll be talking about here this morning in this part of Focus 580. Our guest for the program is Canavery Valencius. She is an assistant professor at Washington University in St. Louis. She's an historian of the 19th century and is the author of the book, The Health of the Country. And the subtitle is How American Settlers Understood Themselves and Their Land. It's published by Basic Books, and it indeed looks at the period in the United States before the Civil War, the period of westward expansion, and this very issue of people and how they thought about this relationship between health and geography. This, in fact, this book is based on her doctoral thesis. She got her PhD from Harvard. That thesis won the Allen Nevins Prize from the Society of American Historians for the best written dissertation on American history. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And we certainly welcome questions if people want to join the conversation, asking only that people try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. Anyone's, though, welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Valencius, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
So it seems that this the issue of geography of health or environmental health and those connections, that's been something you've been interested in for a lot of your academic career, I guess.
That's right. And it's something that I think increasingly many Americans are interested in our own personal lives. So it was fascinating to me to find in records of 19th century people, which I think many of us tend to think of as kind of old and musty and dusty and not having much relevance to our lives, very similar kinds of concerns with the ways in which their physical surroundings would affect them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, and obviously it was something that you noticed, that how much of these sort of writings, and these were not scholarly writings, these were writings of regular folks, as they talked about where they were going, where they traveled, where they wanted to live, trying to pick a good place, that they so often talked about places as being healthy, that they would say, I found this place and I want to settle there and I think it'll be a great place to live with my family and I think it's a healthy place.
That's right. That's exactly the language. And what was interesting to me is that they wouldn't say, not only I will be healthy there or my family will enjoy good health there, but they would say it's a healthy place. Or they would say, I don't want to go there because it's a sickly valley or an insalubrious climate. And what was interesting to me was to try to get at what was it that gave these qualities of health to places, not simply to people, to animate human beings, but to surroundings. Mm-hmm. And what I found in going through lots of writings from the 19th century was that 19th century folks understood the surrounding world to operate in sort of intelligible ways, that the world around them wasn't so separate from them, that the same kinds of properties of balance of forces and balances, you know, balance is a good thing and a balance between flowing movement makes you healthy, and when things get out of whack and out of equilibrium, that makes something sickly. Mm-hmm. And that was true in terrain, just as they understood it. They thought that was true in their own selves.
Well, I think that's what is fascinating. And I hesitate to use the word charming, but I think that is part of it. That the idea that for them, their understanding of their own bodies and how they worked, those provided metaphors that they used as they talked about and tried to understand the landscape and the earth and how it worked.
And you know what was fascinating to me was that this is a profoundly agricultural world. So I think it's not even that people necessarily looked to their physical selves and looked outward, but I think, you know, these are folks people living in slavery, people who are free, but who also were farming and taking care of chickens and cows and ducks and mules and working on land most of the time, that they lived in and among the earth, the soil, breezes, trees, different kinds of flowing waters, you know, flooding waters or droughts, periods of drought, and that the outside world that I think many of us, you know, attempt to control, many of us are probably sitting in air-conditioned containers of rooms right now, that I think we've lost some of that sense in which the physical world would be so much a part of yourself that you wouldn't make a categorical distinction with how you'd understand that versus your own body.
And something I think it also, in looking at the book and the experiences of people, I think it serves as a reminder of what a difficult undertaking this was, where people were moving into environments and ecosystems that were very unfamiliar to them. It wasn't like what they were used to where they grew up, and where making the right choice of the place to live could literally make the difference between success and failure, and maybe even between living and dying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, these were vital choices. One Irish immigrant, whom I quote in the book in 1819, is looking at a piece of land, and he says, I will, in the course of this season, go out to enter 320 acres of land, that is, to purchase it, in some healthy place where there is good land. So what he's saying, he's writing to his brother back in Ireland right then, is I'm going to find some place where not only I can make a good, I can farm well, and I can make a good start for my family and probably for his extended family, because immigrants frequently brought over brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles once they got established, but where he would also find health. And that was a crucial choice for 19th century people. Where they found sickly land, they did their best to avoid it. If they were slave owners, they might put their own family up on, say, on higher ground, and then send their slaves to work in the more sickly bottomlands. They did everything they could to take themselves into zones that they felt to have positive environmental effects on their health, and to keep themselves away from sickly places.
Mm-hmm. And again, so going back, I guess I'm thinking of the same track about how difficult and challenging this was. It was interesting to read here that for people who did make this remove, you know, they moved themselves from places they knew to these new places to try to make new homes. It seemed that just about the first thing that happened to them was they got sick.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one crucial difference between our experience and that of the 19th century and many eras before then as well, was that when you moved, particularly for people of this era, it was particularly crucial if you moved latitudes, that is, if you went from some place of shorter days to longer days, or from some place that was cooler to some place hotter, you would get sick. And indeed, their experience would bear this out, in part because of the prevalence of malaria up and down the Mississippi Valley in this period. So most folks who moved to the mid part of this country would get what they called the shakes. They'd get the ague, was another word for it. Mm-hmm. And that was these terrifying and often fatal and almost always debilitating periods of fever and alternating with incredible chill. So it was not only that you were sick, but also that you would get feverishly delirious and be taken sort of out of yourself in the way that you are with a real high fever, and that you also would be kind of dramatically out of kilter with the world. I mean, it would be late August, and you would be so cold that your relatives would be piling blankets on you and building roaring fires to try to keep you warm. And then all of a sudden you'd go back up into a high fever. This was terrifying and disorienting to people. It's malaria. It killed a lot of people. It took away the strength of many other workers. But that was the main introduction that many people had to the new country that many of them came to try to conquer, to try to take over, to try to claim for themselves and make a new life in.
It would seem that it was almost a sort of a test, a winnowing of who was strong enough to make it and who wouldn't.
You know, what's interesting is I expected to find that reading 19th century literature, and I didn't really find that kind of imagery so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I found was more that people, even some of the people who had the most sort of bold and conquering language about what they were doing, they expected that going to a new place would fundamentally change them. So there's almost a kind of humility in that approach, that it's not will I be strong enough, but I will be transformed. I will be remade. It's what they called this process, acclimation, that you would be acclimated to your new place. And we would find some medical explanation for this primarily in terms of a body's adjustment to malaria. I mean, that is, once you've had malaria, you can come to a kind of more or less an equilibrium with the malarial parasite in which you're not ferociously ill. Then again, you're not completely healthy either, but you no longer have those vertiginous oscillations between fever and cold. But 19th century people didn't expect to be unchanged when they did something as important as moving west.
And they weren't thinking of this just as a metaphor. They weren't thinking of it in psychological, spiritual terms. They were thinking of that in literal, physical terms.
Well, you know, one of the great things about 19th century writings is they were doing all of those at once. Not that it's too early for psychology in a self-conscious sense, but this also very much had a spiritual dimension. I mean, people talked about what they called the crisis of illness and the crisis of the soul, you know, in a moment of salvation or of recognizing God's glory. These were very closely related. And indeed, you know, people who got very ill and felt themselves to be close to death often had spiritual experiences. So in that sense, it's not that they felt it was only physical, but these changes were physical, they could be spiritual, they had to do with one's relationship to one's family, because remember that a lot of folks moving west, particularly those in slavery, but also free people, might never see the family they left behind. So the kind of meaning of going to new country operated at many, many different levels simultaneously.
Our guest this morning, Conavery Valencius, she teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. She's an historian of the 19th century. She grew up in Little Rock, or was a native of Little Rock, Arkansas, she's the author of the book The Health of the Country, which looks at how 19th century Americans, those who were moving west, who were settling there, how it is they thought about the relationship between their health and well-being and the place where they lived. It's published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess we really haven't talked about, and that is, you made the point that people in a very literal way talked about healthy places and unhealthy places and what they were looking for when they were thinking about where they'd like to build a home and farm and raise their families. They were looking for healthy places. So people of this time, as they were thinking about this, what made a healthy place? Why is it some places were healthy and some places were unhealthy?
So a perfectly healthy place in the language of this era would be some place that was slightly elevated, that got good sunshine but wasn't too baking hot, that got nice pleasant breezes but not roaring gales, some place that was near a water source but not near stagnant water, and where there were trees and vegetation nearby, but not too thick, not too rank, not too dense forests nearby. So some place sort of park-like on the side of a low hill would be ideal. Now, you can imagine that folks moving into the Mississippi Valley, for instance, found very few places that matched that idealized conception. Instead, what they found very frequently was incredibly fertile land that was also, in their understanding, extremely sickly, or in their language, insalubrious. And it was sickly because it was low land, because it was land that was often overrun by floods. Remember, this is before the Corps of Engineers has controlled the American waterways. So this is when people would experience flooding and beaver dams that would back up small creeks on a regular basis and so on. So land that often had still and stagnant water. And that kind of water would often produce what 19th century people understood as miasmas. And miasma is a fascinating concept because it's kind of it's a catch-all in the same way that I think germs are for us. That is, a miasma is something that's like a fog or a smoke. It involves bad smell. It's sort of gross yuckiness that's produced by rotting things, by swampland, by stagnant water. And any place that produces miasmas will cause illness to human beings. Now, the problem was that good land was often bottomland, was often land right near rivers and in river valleys, and those areas were, in 19th century terms, highly miasmatic. So there was always a kind of bargain. You know, I'll go to this place, I'll get a couple crops out, then maybe we'll move to someplace more healthy. Or Or what people often did was try to move someplace sickly and drain it, clear it, move away some of the vegetation, burn it down, convert wild land into settled and ordered countryside, and therefore, and this is the radical way in which 19th century people understood their own role with respect to the environment, and by doing those things, they could produce more healthy land. So they could actually transform the health of their environments, they thought, by making them into domesticated landscape.
So it seems pretty obvious, thinking, listening to that description of sickly land and why, and listening to what they thought were the problem. It seems the obvious explanation it invites is, well, we also know that land like that, what it's going to do is it's going to produce a lot of mosquitoes, and they're going to carry malaria, and that's why people are going to get the ague. Even they didn't know that that's what it was that was were at work. Was that the primary, as we would see it now, what the primary issue was with terrain like that?
Malaria was by far the kind of underlying constant in sickliness and health in much of the United States, particularly the southern portions of the Mississippi Valley, throughout the 19th century. Now, on top of malaria, you've got all kinds of infections, complications of childbirth, farm accidents, and sweeping epidemics that would come through. Epidemics, say, of cholera, which was a fearsome disease that could kill people very suddenly. It spread, it's also a parasitic disease, and it's spread through contaminated water sources, which was a real problem, particularly of crowded cities in this era. You could have epidemics of scarlet fever, of whooping cough, of typhoid, and then less epidemic but endemic and affecting almost every family in this period was also what 19th century people called consumption, what we would call tuberculosis. So people of the 19th century dealt with a variety of problems of health on an almost daily basis. And for those moving west, malaria was particularly at issue. And so, yes, we would understand the mosquitoes as one reason why swampy places are unhealthy. But what was interesting to me in reading these sources is that 19th century people weren't in a sense interested to reduce their environments down to one thing. I mean, they felt that some place that had hot, humid heat and was smelly and swampy would be bad for you in all kinds of ways. And I think that more holistic understanding of environment is key to getting at what 19th century people sort of thought about their bodies and about the land around them.
We have some callers. In fact, our lines are filling up, so we will see what's on the minds of the people who are listening. Starting out with a caller in Urbana on our line number one. First person in here. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. This is very interesting. I have a family that started out in the East Coast and gradually moved west, and you've excited me to go and check out my letter collection. I have one dated June 21st, 1836, which is written from Mount Morris, New York, about the death of a relative who had gone to the Fox River area to buy land in Kane County. And I just looked at the letter here, and it says, Erastus Park has gone to Illinois to see to Elijah's land and business. When he died was the reason he did not get the news sooner. Erastus thinks it is a good country where Elijah bought and healthy. Eliab Park had the care of Elijah through all of his sickness, which must have been very gratifying to the both. And then there's another one. When they moved farther, this is a different branch of the family, written on 12th of June, 1842, from Keokuk in the Iowa Territory, talking about all the people who have died.
You know, what I'm hearing in those letters is this sort of capsule of many people's and many families' experiences in most of the 19th century. That is this kind of chain migration where some family members, usually the young men, the young unattached men, or sometimes married couples, would move west and move into what was then new territory to them. Of course, it was inhabited by other people, but to them it was new. Find land, establish themselves, and then write back for other family members. What I'm also hearing is the prevalence of sickness that could often be mortal sickness, and the way in which care for other people and the kind of the intimate and tender duties of nursing someone through an illness, emptying bedpans, cleaning sheets, wringing out cloths, and keep a feverish person cool. But that was something that many people engaged in. And here, and these relatives of yours, men engaged in many of the same ways that women did.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just, as a historian, I can't resist putting in a little plug here that you and other listeners, if you have wonderful documents like this, I hope you consider either depositing originals or at least giving copies to your local historical society, because these are wonderful, fascinating documents of not only each family's history, but also of our common heritage as Americans.
Yeah.
So think about it.
Well, I'm working on that.
Wonderful. Thank you. All historians appreciate this.
Can I just read another little excerpt?
Oh, sure.
Okay, this one was dated December 3rd, 1842. These are my great-great-great-grandparents. They had 10 children, and they went to Keokuk in 1840. And the two parents both were dead by 1844, leaving some very young children. Dear brother, I take this opportunity to inform you I am well and hope these few lines find you the same, but we have had a great deal of sickness. Mother is dead. She died the 8th day of November. She was sick about 6 weeks with bilious fever. She was crazy about 2 weeks, so died very easy and very sudden. She was rational for a week before she died. Father has been sick for 3 months with the bilious fever and chills. He had not been out of doors for a week. And this is written, I think, from one of the children to his brother, the one who stayed back in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of an organization? I mean, I've got seven letters in this series from Keokuk. Would the state of Iowa, or who would really appreciate having a copy of these kinds of things?
You know, most the state historical societies and state archives, mm-hmm. and there are also, I'm not familiar with the ones right near where you are, but there are sometimes also smaller collections of county historical societies.
Now, we've got an excellent one here.
Yeah, if you look in the blue pages of your phone book or look online for the State Historical Society, they can get you to where you want to mm-hmm. be, and they will actually do a lot of work to preserve and make sure that aging paper, you know, is carefully tended to and that these letters can be made available.
Yeah.
But this is fascinating stuff. I mean, this I think for many of us, the kind of drama in this spare 19th century prose of maybe an older child or an adolescent or a young person writing to a sibling about the mm-hmm. death of parents.
Yes.
And in that short remark, you know, she was crazy for 2 weeks, and then she's better, so she died easy.
Yeah.
Imagine what it must be like.
Right. I think this person was probably 16 or so when he wrote the letter.
Oh, and to be the responsible adult, essentially.
Right.
Taking care of a sick parent in what were generally very, very small and by our standards very crowded surroundings with other siblings to take care of, probably fields to take care of or, you know, a shop to run, depending on what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can get a sense in these small bits of record of what people's lives must have been like in this era.
Yes, I'm so fortunate to have this collection. The earliest letter I have was written in 1806, and I probably have at least 50 of them.
Oh, what a
Somebody in my family was very much into collecting this sort of thing, and I'm just so fortunate. I've been transcribing them.
Oh, terrific. What a wealth.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for sharing
this
that with us.
It's a wonderful topic.
We are already at our midpoint here in this part of Focus, and I would like to introduce again our guest, and we'll take some more calls. Our guest is Conavere Valencius, and her name, she's got more name than anybody I've talked to in some time here, Conavere Bolton Valencius. And so if you're going to go look for the book, her last name is spelled Valencius, and her first name, Conavere, Conevery. She teaches at Washington University in St. Louis and is the author of this book. And if you're interested in this subject, you definitely should look for the book. It's titled The Health of the Country, How American Settlers Understood Themselves and Their Land. And it's published by Basic Books. And it takes a look at how settlers in the 19th century, in the years before the Civil War, people who were moving west, how they thought about the relationship between the place that they lived and their health. We have some other folks to talk with, and let us do that. And next is Belgium, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I find it very interesting. One of the even though you mainly are speaking here in the Midwest, an area that was definitely affected in the same way, is our nation's capital.
Mm.
For years and years and years, it was a horrid place to live for exactly the same reasons you said. A lot of malaria, yellow fever, things like that, just decimated people. I thought it was interesting that that would be the ground that they left to the government. Also, Indianapolis had a lot of problems like that.
Mm.
Very serious city that had serious problems for a long time in its formative years with exactly the same problems. And here, where we're at, in East Central Illinois, our topography made us so we had a lot of marshes and stuff. It wasn't near rivers, but the land was very, very swampy and wet. And it took years and years to drain the ground. But once they did, we grow great crops, but our forefathers suffered for it dearly.
Some of the most innovative methods for draining swampland were actually pioneered in Illinois because of the swampland up there.
Yes, we were essentially glacial ponds that filled up with soil and stuff and always stayed wet. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One of the things that this caller is highlighting is the way in which the search for a healthy place was so often frustrated. I mean, many throughout the 19th century, particularly in the early part, there were incredible criticisms directed toward Washington, D.C., because it was regarded widely and largely correctly as just a cesspool of sickness, partly for the hot, humid summers and the swampiness of its topography. Many people who wanted to go to fertile land and who were discovering the incredible richness of what was then prairie soil were also discovering that that soil was swampy or could be overrun or during certain months of the year would sort of change into marshland. So this ideal of finding healthy land was often a kind of it was often just that. It remained an ideal, but in fact, people of the 19th century often lived lives mired in sickness.
Mm, very interesting. Well, let's go on here. Let's talk with someone else, and the next person will be back here in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Just a comment. Your discussion of the malaria problem reminds me that the tradition in the family was that when my family moved into northern Illinois in the Geneva area, which is also Kane County, there was a daily ritual of taking quinine throughout the warm months.
Mm.
I'm not sure when they no longer had to do this, certainly by the turn of the century, although I believe my grandmother had told my father that she could remember taking quinine.
Hmm.
She'd have been born about 1880.
Quinine was a major remedy throughout the 19th century, and in fact, many of us who enjoy sipping a gin and tonic made of tonic water that has quinine in it are enjoying a sort of relic of this anti-malarial heritage. Quinine reduced the fevers, and helped alleviate some of the symptoms of malaria, and in some areas was also used as a preventative against what was known as the ague then. Of course, it was hard to get. It was called Peruvian bark from cinchona, the South American tree from which it was derived at that time. And many people, hucksters, would sell fake bark for very, very high prices. And settlers who lived in very, very remote regions often would go to great lengths to try to locate the bark, as they called it, or to locate other kinds of patent remedies which they hoped would alleviate their symptoms.
I think what many people don't realize in this area today that most of central and northern Illinois was a wetland prairie.
Yes.
And it wasn't just the kettles, but the flatland. Much of it was underwater for, say, a third or a half of the year.
Which we can easily picture why that's challenging to people trying to grow crops, but it was also challenging to people trying to get anywhere and use roads and to stay healthy.
Rather interestingly, the Anopheles mosquito is still here. The malaria is gone. And I'm not sure of just what the reason was. In Europe, it's been hypothesized that the introduction of large numbers of cattle had something to do with it, that the mosquitoes would feed on cattle, but the malaria parasite could not reproduce in their bloodstream, and that this gradually lessen the incidence?
Mosquitoes that carry the malarial parasite don't generally fly very far from the ponds in which they hatch. So if you can kill enough mosquitoes or cover the water with oil or use insecticide to kill them, or if you have human populations who are potential reservoirs for the parasite who are scattered enough that a person who gets infected with malaria doesn't get bitten by a mosquito which then flies to someone else very easily, then you can keep down the malaria. And part of what's happened, one historian has recently argued, that rates of malaria actually began to decline precipitously in the United States even before the introduction in the 1950s, shortly after World War II, of insecticides. And that started because of the agricultural disruption at the time of the Great Depression and the fact that many, many people who had lived and worked in lowland agricultural areas found themselves out of work, unable to support themselves, and moved to cities. And that effectively decreased the reservoir available to propagate malaria.
Well, malaria disappeared from Kane County, I think, before the turn of this century, so that would have been 50 years before that. So I'm not sure. Certainly insecticide had nothing to do with it, but the drainage of the land certainly would have, because it was virtually all drained by then.
Mm-hmm. The story of malarial decline is quite interesting because there isn't any one. I mean, we might think that the magic bullet of bug spray would do it, but that's not it. That's not solely it. It's drainage. It's changing agricultural patterns, changing population patterns and demographics, and also reduction in mosquito populations through chemical means.
Well, very interesting.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go again to another Urbana person. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Found an ancestors of my husband's who died in 1849 in Sandusky County, Ohio, which is southwest of Cleveland, still northern part of Ohio. And I couldn't figure out how she died, why she died, until I talked with my husband's aunts who knew the story that she died of swamp fever. Recently, there were cases of modern swamp fever in not far from us, I think it was Decatur or Springfield, Illinois. And I was wondering, describe the parasite or call the parasite or the disease leptospirosis. So I was wondering whether you'd run across the term swamp fever and whether it was in the middle of the 1800s anything thought of as anything different than malaria or whether it was a different disease. Or do you have any idea?
Well, this is where it can be both sort of paradoxically both frustrating and enlightening to look at 19th century records. It's real frustrating if you want to know, in our modern terms, what did someone die of. Because, yes, swamp fever is a term that's used, but, you know, it often gets used along with a lot of other terms for kinds of fevers, and they sometimes overlap, and sometimes, in fact, very often, 19th century definitions are not particularly consistent. And also, many, many people probably in the end succumbed to a combination of illnesses. That is, someone who died in childbirth, well, she might have recovered from that difficult childbirth if she hadn't always also been weakened by malaria and by a very a diet that was very vitamin poor. You know, so that there are many different kinds of factors that would go into any one person's demise. Now, that's real frustrating to those of us who are trying to find out, you know, exactly what was going on in our modern terms. But I think it's also enlightening in terms of understanding how it is that people of that era would understand their health. So swamp fever wasn't necessarily a particular thing. It was more like a condition of fever that could then become another fever if what they called predisposing causes would change that fever. You see, so that kinds of disease weren't as specifically different as they are today, or they weren't understood that way. Instead, different diseases could shade into one another depending on the course of the illness in an individual person's body.
Well, she did have her last child of two in May of 48, and she dies in January of 49, so it was only 7 months later, presumably, the childbirth had... was a factor in all of this.
She was probably nursing, which takes, you know, which makes a woman's body work very hard to produce milk for a child of that age. How old were her other children, do you know?
Oh, she had a son who was born 3 years before that, before the second child.
And keep in mind, too, that very frequently in 19th century families, if you have a couple kids born and then there seems to be a little more of a gap, there may well have been a miscarriage in between. So in other words, the number of pregnancies is actually often far greater, or is often greater than the number of children who live into infancy.
Yeah.
So that the toll, when we're looking particularly at women's health, the very high fertility rates, particularly among women moving into the South and West who tended to have more children than women in more settled parts of the Northeast, that the physical work that women's bodies did in becoming pregnant and sustaining children both before and after birth is a huge factor in understanding what they got sick of or how they survived.
It was very interesting, speaking of a different part of the country but similar time. I've mentioned this on the calling in before, but it was really interesting to go to the Tenement Museum in the Lower East Side of New York City because they talk about the health issues and why people got so sick and pointed out that the way that New York City was developed was that they built the buildings on the street kind of in a donut fashion facing the street, and in the middle of the block was the outhouse and the well and where you dumped your garbage.
It frequently right next to each other.
Yeah. Plus the crowded conditions, so you no wonder so many people became so ill. Thanks, it's really interesting.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest, Conover Valencius, the book is titled The Health of the Country, How American Settlers Understood Themselves and Their Land. She's assistant professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We're here still talking about a time when people, as they tried to understand and think about the body and how it worked and why people got sick, there was still this idea that there were these basic forces in the body, and as long as things were relatively in balance, that people were all right. But it was when things got out of balance that there were problems. And that was the thinking that underlied the medical practice of bleeding for such a long period of time. I'm interested in this, how it is that this notion of bodily health and the forces that were at work in the body, how people also took that same kind of thinking and applied it to nature and how nature, the natural environment worked.
I mean, what's fascinating here is I think we have to understand how messy the body really is, right? When we don't use all of our sanitary products and deodorants and modern medical techniques. I mean, 19th century people had, frequently encountered episodes of vomiting, of diarrhea. They certainly sweat like crazy when they were out in the sun. Many more women were lactating than are because of higher rates of childbirth and greater rates of breastfeeding than today. So emanations from the body were much more apparent, and since people couldn't wash their clothes as much as we do today, they were much more with you for longer periods of time. And this notion that the body has stuff inside it that it needs to keep in balance, and you have to, when you have an excess of something, that is, if you drink too much, or if you feel passionate thoughts or rage, or if you drink raw or eat raw food that would be stimulating, then you have maybe too much of what was called a humor in your body, and you need to get that out. And you might get it out by burping or by vomiting, but you might also have to be relieved of it by a physician or a friend or someone down the road who would come bleed you or put a sweat, make you what was called sweating it out, put blankets on you to make you sweat, or apply a poultice or a caustic plaster to raise an irritation in the skin. So what people were doing by those techniques, which sound really barbaric to us today, was to try to replicate the ways in which even a healthy body gets waste products out of itself. They saw that also in what was going on in the land around them. So that, for instance, when a swamp was smelly and gross and gave off gases and odors, that was very similar to what happened to a body when filled with infection or a body who'd eaten the wrong kind of food. So what 19th century people thought, I think very logically in their terms, was that if they wanted to improve the health of land, they should cut into it, they should open it in the same way they would their own bodies. They would plow that land, they would tear up tree roots, try to create openings in the earth to let out foul miasmas that might make them sick, because it would be a process of change which was quite perilous in 19th century terms. But ultimately, that body of land would become more healthy as a result.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. We have some other callers. We'll go to a call here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question for the professor. It's something my husband and I have discussed several times, and I think you've touched on it, but why isn't there, you speak of the miasmas and everything, why is there so little malaria, at least in this country now? Is it because of the draining of the swamps?
It is because of draining of swamps. It's because we use chemical insecticides to kill reservoirs of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we no longer have large portions of our population working in watery labor, draining swamps, raising rice, raising cotton, raising soybeans.
Sure.
Largely that's mechanized today.
Yeah.
So we don't have large groups of people who are working in fields, and we don't have large groups of farm workers' families living in unscreened, un-air-conditioned shacks near farms.
Yeah.
So we've removed a lot of the potential reservoir of malaria. We've also eliminated a lot of the habitats for mosquitoes, and we have sprayed enough that we no longer have endemic malaria in this country. Now, what we are seeing is a resurgence in forms of malaria-borne disease. That is, mosquito-borne disease. So we haven't quite figured out how to control mosquitoes. Many parts of this country have been fearing this summer West Nile virus.
Yes.
Right? We are much more aware of mosquito transmission now than people could have been 100 years ago. And what we're attempting, or 150 years ago, now there are campaigns, for instance, in my home city, St. Louis, that homeowners are encouraged to check, their backyards for any small, even really quite minuscule sources of stagnant water in which mosquitoes could be breeding.
Very interesting. Would I have time for a second question?
Well, I have one other person, and I only have a couple minutes.
Right.
Thanks for being understanding, because I would like to try to and get one more person
sure.
in here.
I understand that.
And
thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This would be a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that or ask if your guest could compare how very much worse it would be to the closer you get to the equator in the 19th century. The reason I say that is because of some economists recently, particularly William Masters of Purdue University and Margaret McMillan of Tufts, came up with a theory saying that it's really what makes some countries wealthy and some countries poor is more that frost is available because it increases agricultural productivity and it helps control diseases, in particular malaria. So I just wanted to bring that dimension into your discussion.
You know, what's fascinating to me about that kind of economic theory and also about some of the kind of environmental conversations that we have today are the ways in which those come back to and hearken back to 19th century notions. I mean, this idea that zones of the world are largely defined by latitude and that one personal health and social well-being and economic well-being can be largely attributed to one's latitude, I mean, that is a fundamental notion of 19th century geography and medical geography. What's so interesting to me is that I think largely because our conversations about the essences of people have changed. I mean, that is, we no longer, most of us, think that human beings are physically formed by the environments that we come from or live in. And so we tend to to think, well, no, we can just go to a new place and not be changed by that. You can have a company and move its workers to a new state, and that doesn't change the operations of the company. 19th century people would say, what are you talking about? Those new people have to be acclimated. They have to become in balance with their new, form an equilibrium with their new environment. And of course, they will have different patterns of life. They'll have different forms of productivity. They will be radically altered by that change. And I wonder whether, to some extent, we're coming around to question some of this notion in our modern world that things can be exactly the same and be homogenous in different places.
There is so much more that I would like to be able to ask, and we're coming down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left. In fact, just about one or two. We talked about the fact that here people were coming from places where they had been raised and grown up into different environments, had different kind of challenges to their health. Were there also things that people found in the environment to aid their health?
Oh, absolutely. Many Americans coming into places copied Native American cures. They often felt that, basically, that the notion was that where God put a disease, there he would also put cures for it. So people searched endlessly into the fruits, the nuts, the herbs, the earth even, the soils of new places or places new to them to try to find cures. And one of the main places people looked was to different kinds of water. I mean, we tend to think of water as just one thing that comes out of our tap or that we maybe buy in a plastic bottle on a supermarket shelf. But to 19th century folks, water was just a variety of stuff. So black, sulfurous water from a mineral spring could taste foul and smell awful, but could restore you to good health if you were sick. Other kinds of mineral waters could be good for certain particular ailments. Muddy water of the Mississippi was said to be very healthful because it would keep your body because it was strong water and it would keep your body strong. So looking for the waters of a place was a crucial aspect of 19th century settlement, not only because waterways were the way people got around and communicated and because they needed water to farm, but also because different kinds of waters, springs and rivers and creeks and so on, were important as part of a medical understanding of the world.
Well, we're going to have to stop, and for people who would like to read more on the subject, I certainly will recommend that you look at the book we've been talking about, which is titled The Health of the Country by Conavery Valencius. Again, her last name is spelled Valencius, and it's published by Basic Books. Conavery Valencius teaches at Washington University in St. Louis, where she lives. Thanks very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.